Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, there are fresh calls for the SANDF chief to be fired after the Iran visit controversy continues. South African house prices climbing faster than inflation. What's driving the surge? The US and China strike a rare deal, America to claim 15% of Chinese AI chip sales. And why artificial intelligence can't replace humans in the hiring process. The hidden flaws of robot recruitment. It's Monday, the 18th of August. Now, South Africa is facing a foreign policy storm that shows no sign of abating. The chief of the Defence Force, General Rudzani Maphanya, is accused of acting outside his mandate during a trip to Iran, a visit purportedly approved by the Defence Minister, Angie Motshekga, but not by the President. Now, the non-profit organisation Citizens for Integrity says both must go, warning that this breach of protocol threatens South Africa's credibility on the global stage. The chief executive officer is Mark Hyman, and he is with me on the program now. Mark, a very warm welcome. Why do you believe this incident is so serious then for our country's foreign policy credibility?
Good afternoon, Jeremy, and good afternoon to all your listeners. As far as Citizens for Integrity is concerned, and I think if we can begin with this, what happened with General Maphanya's visit to Iran is not just a diplomatic misstep. It's a serious breach of South Africa's constitutional and executive protocol, and it demands urgent accountability at the highest level. As the sitting chief of the South African National Defence Force, General Maphanya travelled to Iran and made political statements on South Africa's behalf. He said, and I quote, "This visit carries a political message. The Republic of South Africa and the Islamic Republic of Iran have common goals." Now, that's not military diplomacy. That's a political declaration made without any authorization, without oversight, and without knowledge purportedly of the head of state. That's unacceptable.
Why do you hold Minister Motshekga equally responsible for this breach?
Well, we have seen and we heard on Friday on your show, the Department of Defense and the spokesperson, Onika Kwakwa, made a very clear statement. She said he was given authority by the Minister of Defense to go to Iran and made the following statement on your show on Friday. "We do not have any influence in what is being said in meetings or public spaces in other countries. We do not make political or policy decisions." Now, you know, the trip was authorized by the Minister of Defense, Angie Motshekga. And as such, she holds accountability for what her head of the military said in Iran.
Mark Hyman, you suggest that this threatens South Africa's relations not only with the United States but other key partners in the West. Are you able to quantify that for me? What are the consequences of this, do you think, in immediate and practical terms?
Well, I think that we're looking at things that are not theoretical. We're looking at the loss of tens of thousands of jobs in South Africa, with our unemployment that grew by a further 0.3% last week. And that rate is climbing against the last quarter. These are not jobs we can afford to lose. The knock-on effects are very, very real. Foreign investors could interpret this as a shift in our geopolitical alignment and leave us as they did in 1986-87 after the Rubicon speech.
There seems to be a lot of prevaricating as far as this is concerned. Realistically, does your organization actually expect anything to happen?
We hope that it'll happen. I think a lot depends on the seriousness with which President Ramaphosa will take this. I believe he has to, as we're involved very heavily at this point in time in attempting to avoid the excessive tariffs that have been placed on South Africa by the United States. And I think that this could have a knock-on effect, despite the fact of the encouraging trip from the EU. I believe that it could have a knock-on effect to American part, to not only to the American situation, but to other European and other countries who will look to South Africa and say, where is your non-alignment?
You've used the word hope on a couple of occasions in this conversation, Mark Hyman. Do you think President Ramaphosa is too lenient in dealing with constitutional breaches?
We have seen leniency. However, by the same token, we have seen a very stern action, as is the case in point of the former Deputy Minister of Trade and Industry, Andrew Whitfield, who was unceremoniously dismissed for visiting the United States on behalf of his own party without the necessary consent from the president, and therefore in exactly the same way double standard should not be applied, and the head of the military should in exactly the same instance be dismissed accordingly.
So you're suggesting the Whitfield issue sets an almost unblockable precedent here?
It definitely sets a precedent by virtue of the fact that the general of the head of the military is appointed by the state president, and in exactly the same way as he has the right to appoint and to dismiss members of his cabinet, he in exactly the same way has the right to dismiss members of the military under whose office he makes the appointment.
Beyond dismissal, are there other steps, in your opinion, that government could take to restore confidence in our diplomatic processes?
It's our view as Citizens for Integrity that South Africa has stepped well beyond the bounds of diplomacy in terms of its various plays in what they term as a non-aligned environment, yet are aligning with rogue character states like Iran. And if Durka and the president who set the policy of foreign policy, together with Ronald Lamola, the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, were to reassess their position and not necessarily realign, but come to the table and meet with the Western world and stop prevaricating in the Eastern Bloc and dealing with rogue states as we have been doing for the past 3 years.
And just quickly, if there is continued inertia, would your organization take this to court?
We would have to think about that very carefully, and I would suggest that based on the Whitfield matter, we would definitely consider taking this matter further by virtue of the extensive damage that this has and will have for this country going into the future.
Mark Hyman is the Chief Executive Officer of the non-profit Citizens for Integrity. Smart minds, big moves, one summit. Join the country's leading thinkers, doers, and decision makers at the MoneyWeb Money Summit. It's happening on the 9th of September at the Sandton Convention Center. It's one full day of powerful insights, real opportunities, and bold conversations shaping South Africa's economic future. And the best part? Your ticket is free. Just use the code MoneyWebGuest when you register. Visit moneysummit.co.za now. MoneyWeb Money Summit, where smart money moves.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, here's some good news. South Africa's housing market seemingly has turned a corner. According to the latest FNB Residential Property Barometer, house prices are now rising faster than inflation. And if I'm not mistaken, that would be the first time since the pandemic. Sectional title properties are leading the charge, edging past freestanding homes as lifestyle shifts, affordability constraints change, and also work habits are reshaping buyer behavior. So let's discuss what is driving the trend, and perhaps more importantly, is it sustainable? Economist at FNB, senior economist Sipa Mandla Mkwanazi, a very warm welcome to you. So, some good news here. How significant is it that house prices are outpacing inflation? Do you think it's a turning point, or are we seeing something just of a temporary blip here?
No, thank you for having me, Jeremy. Well, we often say that for households, their houses are their biggest investment. That rings true for many South Africans. Now, the fact that we are seeing the value of their properties rising above inflation, it means, you know, their wealth levels are rising alongside the rising property prices. Now, we raise a good question whether this is only temporary or we are seeing a significant shift. Now, you have to look from the supply side of things to check the trends from that perspective. Now, if you look at the supply of new properties, so the construction of new homes, it's not doing very well. I mean, it's linked to, you know, the subdued construction market. We are not seeing those properties coming through at a fast enough pace. So from a supply side of things, there appears to be this constrained supply of new properties, which is supporting the rise in prices. Now, on the demand side of things, interest rates have come down a little bit. There are expectations that there will be further cuts in the outer years at least, and that is supportive of demand as well. So from both sides of the equation, there appears to be sufficient support for the rising trend in house prices.
So you raised the important point about interest rates, so that the SARB rate cuts have certainly helped, but the big question is whether buyers are going to get meaningful relief anytime before 2027. That's the kind of big unknown, isn't it?
That is a big unknown. We heard from the SARB that they are shifting their preference of the level of inflation tolerance from 4.5% to around 3% now. That suggests that they are probably going to want to keep interest rate restrictive and guide inflation towards that 3% level. So it's possible, from our view at least, that we will see interest rates remaining at these levels for quite some time before we see shifts lower, and we predict that to be somewhere around 2027 or so. From the demand side of things, we are more now looking towards rising wages to continue to support demand for property. We see that for workers, at least, they haven't gotten wage increases above inflation since 2021. And it's the first time since then that we are now starting to see an acceleration in wage growth. So that support is likely now to come from wages rather than further cuts in interest rates in the medium term.
And how much of this price growth is being driven by first-time buyers versus investors?
First-time buyers, they've been quite hesitant to come back into the market. We are only now starting to see, with the latest two cuts in interest rates, starting to see first-time buyers really starting to come back to the market. That isn't surprising, Jeremy, if you think of the cost of living crisis that we have recently come out of. So there are these psychological effects from first-time buyers. We did see first-time buyers jumping into the market when interest rates were at their ultra-low levels, and some of them got their fingers burnt when interest rates increased at such an aggressive rate. So we did see in the latest cycle a bit of hesitancy from first-time buyers. So the first part of this rising trend was driven by your more experienced investors, but we are now starting to see first-time buyers coming back to the market.
Let me ask you about sectional titles, which, as I mentioned, are now outperforming freestanding homes for the first time in years. Why is that?
So if you think back to the pandemic, we saw buyers preferring bigger homes to facilitate work from home. There was home schooling for some parents. You needed to stretch your legs, so you would want a bigger home with a garden, so you stretch your legs during your break time. That supported your freestanding homes because they can facilitate, or they can give you that bit of freedom to stretch your legs. Now, so the first trend in rising prices during that time was driven by by those preference, by those shifts in preference. Now we are seeing a reversal of that. We're going back to the office. I've gone back to the office. Mm-hmm. I go 4 times a week now. So the demand, or rather, we do no longer have those requirements for freestanding homes to stretch our legs because we're now back to the office. That is the first part. The second part is that you still see these remnants of financial pressures I mentioned. So there is still preference for more affordable homes, and sectional titles appear to be offering buyers that affordability. Mm-hmm. When you look at that, the entry point, the average price of a sectional title, combined with the fact that we don't necessarily need to work from home anymore, sectional titles, it makes sense that sectional titles are performing better at the moment.
That makes perfect sense. Are you suggesting, though, that the so-called pandemic premium for bigger homes has completely disappeared?
It is waning. It's definitely waning. We are also seeing, from a regional perspective, that momentum is now shifting more towards inland. If you look at the Western Cape versus Gauteng, obviously the Western Cape is an outperformer here by far, but momentum is now starting to shift back towards inland. Again, it's probably linked to that shift back to the office, and we know that Gauteng is still, you know, the economic hub of South Africa. So both from the type of property as well as from a regional perspective, the pandemic premium is now shifting back to what we know to have been the point before the pandemic.
And those Western Cape prices will continue to cook, no doubt, and moving beyond Cape Town itself.
Moving beyond Cape Town is not necessarily a Cape Town story alone. It's quite spread across the Western Cape. It's more the coastal property story rather than a Cape Town story alone.
Thank you very much indeed, FNB senior economist Sipa Mandla Mkhwanazi. I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, in a move with massive geopolitical and tech industry implications, I think, US chip giants, and I'm talking about NVIDIA and AMD, are going to pay 15% of all AI chip sales to China directly to the US government, effectively taxing the sale of advanced semiconductors into one of the biggest markets. The deal, aimed at tightening Washington's grip on critical AI technology, is raising questions, though, about global supply chains, trade tension, and also the future, the big future of AI innovation. I want to discuss what this means for the United States and China and the rest of the world, us included. And I'm going to talk to Ashraf Patel from the Institute for Global Dialogue. Ashraf, thank you very much for talking to us on this issue. How unprecedented is it then for the US government to take a direct cut from a private company and their sales into a foreign market?
Thanks, Jeremy. I think the current context is the US-China trade talks, is the US-EU trade talks, and U.S. trade talks with much of what is called the Global South. In that context, it's not surprising that the Trump administration is on what is called a transactional trade policy. So most of the trade policy of the U.S. currently under Trump is rooted in a kind of short-term transactional gains as opposed to long-term geopolitical considerations. And that's very interesting. So a lot of nations that have power, such as China and others, are more adept at kind of absorbing this transactionalism. And therefore, one could imagine that the high-level trade talks between US and China has kind of calculated these things. So the AI chip deal vis-a-vis some elements of China's critical mineral trade-offs have kind of been calculated into that equation. So this explains this new deal with the 15% revenue to the U.S. and then giving them the right to export to China, which is kind of a very large market for them.
Is it simplistic if I say that it's essentially an economic sanction in disguise?
I would say it's a bit of both, because tariff wars, by definition, could be classified as a form of sanction. But this is also the kind of out of the deal, good business sense approach of the Trump administration. And then on the side of China and other players, it's a kind of what can we absorb? What do we trade off? in order to get access to the great US market, and vis-a-vis for the US, what do we trade off so we could also get access to the growing Chinese middle class market? So we are definitely, we've entered the phase of trade-offs in international relations these days.
Ashraf, we know how quickly China responded with the implementation of DeepSeek, and it was essentially a stealth operation that ambushed the world in many respects. How do you think China is going to respond directly? Surely this could push the country to accelerate self-sufficiency when it comes to AI chips.
A very interesting question. In fact, the backdrop to this big AI debates is two things. One is China hosted 2 weeks ago the Global AI Summit, and it has made remarkably progressive commitments to a kind of global AI model, global AI governance system that is fairly, on balance, inclusive and provides access to much of the global south to baseline AI technologies. And remarkably, they also factored into in issues such as AI bias and the AI content regulation. So this is a game changer. In fact, one can say the Chinese proposal is not that much different from the EU AI Act. Remarkably progressive. By contrast, the US AI plan under Trump is very much a nationalist, export-driven model, and it harks back to the days of a form of protectionism. So these two different models are kind of competing for the hearts and minds of, let's say, much of the global world. And I think therein makes for a fascinating kind of choices for countries like South Africa and others in saying, you know, how do we balance our role in terms of making choices for technology transfer, AI, etc., etc.? So this is where the real debates are going to take place.
And it's so interesting. How then do we find that balance? What do you think it means for countries who are inevitably going to be caught in the middle of this tech rivalry between Beijing and Washington? And that would include us.
Definitely, definitely. I would say there's a lot of research by very progressive institutes like the Brookings Institute, LSE, Beijing National University. All of them are saying, look, let us look at how the Global South can benefit from both parts. And I would say you need to take an open standards approach to say that we will kind of pick and choose the different parts of the technology stack that best works for our national development at this particular point in time. So strike a balance, strike good deals, but also put your national interests first. I think that would be the big win for South Africa if we can indeed manage to strike a balanced deal.
So chips first, but inevitably Washington might be looking at this as a floating a trial balloon and could set a precedent, surely, for taxing other sensitive tech exports.
Yes, yes, they would invariably do that, but one can definitely begin to see that the very hardball approach of the Trump trade wars, it may give them some short-term gains, but already there are breaks, there are concerns by many industries in the US and the world, and I don't think that the hard and fast Trumpism is going to last very long, because the economic calculus will come in. And much of the world, the way the Trump administration is proceeding, even Europe is moving closer towards deals with China. So the US elites would be mindful that if they push too hard and too fast on the global south, much of the global south would move east. And I think that is another part of their calculation. So again, balance is very important in trade and technology deals.
This is going to be fascinating to see how it unfolds. Ashraf Patel, thank you very much indeed from the Institute for Global Dialogue.
Smart minds, big moves, one summit. Join the country's leading thinkers, doers, and decision makers at the Moneyweb Money Summit. It's happening on the 9th of September at the Sandton Convention Center. It's one full day of powerful insights, real opportunities, and bold conversations shaping South Africa's economic future. And the best part? Your ticket is free. Just use the code MONEYWEBGUEST when you register. Visit moneysummit.co.za now. Moneyweb Money Summit, where smart money moves.
You're listening to Moneyweb at Midday.
Now, artificial intelligence was meant to revolutionize recruitment, making hiring faster, smarter, and maybe even more efficient. But take a listen to this. Instead of solving those problems, it's also creating new ones. It's flooding companies with AI-generated CVs. I've seen a couple of those myself, not impressed. And also, the consequences may be burying exceptional candidates and also eroding trust in the process. So can machines actually replace the human touch when it comes to finding the right person for the job? I want to discuss this with a regular guest on the program, Advaita Naidu, who is Africa MD at Jack Hammer, one of the continent's big executive search firms. So welcome. And you say that AI has made the hiring process more difficult rather than easier. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, I think AI was supposed to revolutionize a lot of things, wasn't it? But I think when it comes to recruitment, it's turned it into something of a professional arms race, because bots end up writing CVs, bots filter the CVs out on the other side, they screen people out. And where we were hoping for peace and efficiency, we have a fair amount of tumult and noise. And the two key problems, I think, are when it comes to volume and then trust, because first, the barriers to entry have been removed because AI on the candidate side makes it that much quicker and easier for people to apply. They actually don't need to take the time themselves to tailor their CVs or their cover letters. In fact, I think they barely have to consider whether this is the right role or the environment for them. They just spray and pray. So there's this huge application inflation, and the immense volume that hiring managers have to contend with means that they're overwhelmed, and they're also ill-equipped to deal with now these very curated applications. And then from a trust and an integrity perspective, these enhanced CVs, they've eroded the CV's value as a reliable signal of suitability, because any written work isn't the differentiator that it used to be in the past, because today they all look good. So it's really hard to pass for authenticity.
So it's not just a volume issue then. You're suggesting it's a much deeper issue as far as authenticity is concerned.
Absolutely. So, I mean, obviously on the employer side, yes, there is the volume. The disadvantage is it's an epic waste of time and productivity to wade through all these wrong applications. And then they do run the risk of losing out on great talent, as you said earlier, because it just gets lost. Or deeper than that, they just become paralyzed into inaction because they don't know who is real and authentic or who is essentially enacting fraud to land a job. And on the candidate side, the disadvantage is, you know, it was already a game of numbers and facelessness, but it just gets further dehumanized by automated rejections or no real feedback. So there's the volume, there's the trust, there's the lack of authenticity, there's a dehumanization. I think it's a downward spiral.
So what's the consequence of a trust collapse in recruitment then?
So I think it means that people just can't trust in the system. You effectively have bots talking to bots. You're going to be missing out on the human nuances that define great hires. And there are just so many cultural and economic dynamics at play. And to cut through the noise, I think companies should really sway back to human-centric strategies, which is really what builds trust in the first place.
I'm interested in the bots talking to bots comment. What does that look like in practice?
So it means that people are using the AI enhancement tools to generate these very curated and very polished CVs, which may or may not reflect their actual ability. It's just embellished to the extent that it gets past the filters. And then the filters are looking at this and thinking, wow, this is great. This ticks all the boxes. And people are going through to a round of decision making or screening that they are actually not equipped to do. And again, that's a waste of time and productivity.
How easy is it to spot the polished AI CV?
So I think there are tools in place that, when coupled with human intervention, can be used much better. And I think I want to caveat by saying it's not that we think that AI is bad. It's that badly used or blanket applied AI is. So putting the humanity back into hiring and making it about actual people again, that's going to help. But the applicant tracking systems and the bot filtering can be curated or changed so that they can flag out the over-templatized CVs, and they can also prioritize signals of learning agility in candidates. You know, people who have gone through internal promotions, they have gone through turnaround contacts, they can flag patterns like skills clusters clusters and reveal any inconsistencies. And so these AI-crafted and overly generic resumes then get filtered out because they are overly templatized and they look too much like each other. And the people who are using it to enhance what was already there, then they go to the top of the pile.
Do you think we're over the precipice here? You talk about bringing humanity back into hiring. Do you think that we can pull back from the edge?
Yes, I think for practical purposes, probably the most value, the best predictive selection tools are things like work sample tests and structured interviews. So if we go back to the days where we prioritize tests of cognitive ability rather than just great written work, we can pull ourselves back. And for us, I mean, yes, we're a recruitment company. So, you know, this is going to sound like a shameless plug to use companies like us. But, you know, using AI to map a market but not to make decision on who gets selected, that's going to work in your favor. Using it to identify passive talent and then going through structured proper interview processes, that's going to work in your favor. And I think using better signals at the front door than the CV, like requesting that work sample or a video that is testing for authenticity and communication skills, and again putting the humanity back, that's going to work because AI struggles to replicate humanity.
So what I'm hearing you say, there is a role for artificial intelligence in the hiring process. It can add value, but there's got to be a judicious and well-planned, almost gatekeeping approach to the process, both from the recruitment company and obviously from the person who's submitting the CV.
That's exactly it. I mean, in South Africa, we don't really have specific regulations yet relating to AI-driven hiring, but I think we can look to some of our global counterparts for some signaling. There are risk management and risk mitigation strategies in place all over the world. There's transparency when it comes to candidate handling through the use of AI by saying, you know, we use AI for administration, but humans actually ultimately make the decisions. So that's also a signal to candidates to use the AI, like you said, judiciously and ethically. Because again, this is about people and people who are doing jobs.
Given the risk that's attached to this, do you think that regulation in time might become a thing?
I think in some states in the US, there are things like algorithms that make sure that disadvantaged or protected categories of people do not get screened out. I think in South Africa, where we have information protection laws, there should be some sort of information processing processes that come into place to protect candidates and employers alike. Again, if people are using AI to embellish paper-based qualifications, they're essentially being fraudulent. So yes, there is definitely room for regulation to come into play. But right now, I think because it's so new, we're all just testing things out and seeing how far we can go.
A whole new human resources frontier. Advaita Naidu, thank you very much indeed. Africa MD at the recruitment company Jack Hammer. And that's where we're going to leave it for this Monday. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.